Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas. Narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 5.
Thomas's proof for the existence of God contains within itself only a minimal indication of him. The proof is not much in comparison with the divine reality itself, but in Thomas's mind that little goes quite a long way. He tells us that even though we can know that God exists, we don't and can't know just what he is. The best we can do is cultivate the precious hints implied in the proof. But we must remember that all names, even positive ones, identify God only by setting him apart from creatures. Names said of God do not give us the kind of knowledge that we normally obtain about things. In an earlier work, Thomas had written,
"The chief way to consider the divine essence is by way of negation. For by its immensity, the divine essence transcends every form attained by our intellect. And so, in apprehending it, we do not know what it is. But by knowing what it is not, we get some knowledge of it. And the more things we are able to deny of it, the nearer we come to knowing it."
In the Summa, Thomas speaks of this negation as knowledge by removal or remotion.
Once we know that a thing exists, there remains the further question of the manner in which it exists. Now, because we cannot know what God is, but rather what he is not, we have no means for considering how God exists. It can be shown how God is not by removing from him whatever is not fitting, and these are composition, motion, and the like.
Thomas starts out to show that God is simple. He disputes the idea that he is complex in any way. We can see this by continuing to compare God to creatures. Every creature has potentiality or passivity in its makeup because that's the nature of any compound. Consider, if in forming a compound, two actual substances were to preserve their own identity, then they would remain two substances. No new single composite would result. Hydrogen would still be hydrogen and oxygen would be oxygen, but they could not combine to become H2O or water, which has very different properties. So every composition has passivity or potentiality in its makeup, whereas God does not. One part of a composite may be an active component, while the other is a more passive component. For example, heat may be the active element in water, and electric current can be active in a metal wire. But the separate components of a compound have the potential to combine into an actual new unity, as malt and water unite to form beer. Each component surrenders the independence that it enjoyed in its pure state. Thomas examines many kinds of compositions and concludes that God is not made according to any of them.
The absolute simplicity of God may be shown in many ways, for there is neither composition of quantitative parts in God, since he is not a body, nor composition of form and matter, nor does his nature differ from his subsistence, nor his essence from his being. Neither is there in him composition of genus and difference, nor of subject and accident. Therefore, it is clear that God is in no way composite, but is altogether simple.
God has no potential to change or combine. The unmoved mover, the uncaused cause, is pure actuality. Thomas remarks,
"It has already been shown that there is some first being whom we call God, and that this first being must be pure act, without the admixture of any potentiality. God is infinite, comprehending in himself all the plenitude of the perfection of all being."
It's important to recognize that Thomas's conclusion is not a generalization arrived at by counting and inspecting every kind of combination. To make his point, he doesn't need to mention every possible composition. His argument holds for anything and everything that has any passivity or potentiality in it at all. Every creature has its own essence and its existence as a fundamental part of its composition. And every creature is contingent. That is, its existence depends on many other things. Thomas says a creature can be what it is only by receiving its existence and essence from the cause of being. Now, God is not made according to any mode of composition, not even any composition of essence and existence. In the first place, God's not made at all. God's very essence is to exist. He exists by his very nature. God is ultimately distinguished from all other creatures because God is being, but creatures only have being. And creatures have their being only as long as God communicates it to them. In a number of articles in the Summa Theologiae, similar arguments are advanced to show that this purely actual, simple God is perfect, good, infinite, omnipresent, changeless, eternal, and unique. In this long argumentation, Thomas begins to make explicit the deepest meaning of his key term, which translates as act or actuality. In doing so, he takes a step beyond his mentor Aristotle. Thomas tells us that the primary meaning of act is not form or substance. Act is the very act of being. Act is existence itself.
Being is what is most perfect in everything, because it is related to everything else as act. For nothing is actual except inasmuch as it exists. And so it is that being itself is the actuality of all things.
And again, he says,
the act of being is that which is most intimate in each and every thing, and what is deepest in them all, since it is formal and decisive in relation to everything else that goes to make up a thing.
It's not surprising, then, that Thomas finds the most fitting name for God to be the very name that God has given himself, a name that human reason recognizes as the supreme name. Following the Latin understanding of a biblical text, Thomas renders the divine name revealed to Moses as He Who Is. In this scriptural expression, Thomas finds theological confirmation of what his philosophy also tells him. God is pure being, or pure act. God is the subsistent being itself. This is a high point for Thomas, since this active sense of being lights up all he has to say about God and creatures. Its importance is shown by the unusually personal way in which Thomas introduces this sense of being in his disputed question on the power of God. In arguing his own position in the Summa and elsewhere, Thomas invariably begins his response with the stock scholastic formula in the impersonal third person. In reply, it must be said. Very rarely does he speak in the first person. But something of the excitement of his insight shows through in the way he draws our attention to the ultimate principle on which everything else depends.
This act of being that I am talking about is the most perfect of all things. And this is obvious from the fact that act is always more perfect than potency. What I call the act of being is the actuality of all acts, and for this reason is the perfection of all perfections. Nothing can be added to the act of being that is extraneous to it, since nothing is extraneous to it except nothing.
This name, pure, subsistent act of being, distinguishes God from creatures in the most absolute way. At the same time, God's name is the most positive and actual of all names, and so Thomas also calls this name the name by way of excellence or supereminence. This name enables us to speak further about God. Since God causes creatures to be, Thomas reasons that some remote likeness of their cause must reside in them. And so we can sort through the various names and the perfections they signify to find some few that will permit us to speak fittingly, though still inadequately, about God. We know already that we can only use names that signify qualities that can be infinitely expanded and elevated. Thus, for example, we can say that God is good and wise because we can't have too much goodness or wisdom. God possesses infinitely expandable qualities in a manner that transcends earthly realities. Yet Thomas says that God is not an impersonal being. Rather, he possesses a supreme intelligence and will, and that he is knowingly and lovingly concerned with his creatures. Thomas puts it,
God necessarily knows things other than himself, for it is manifest that he perfectly understands himself. Otherwise, his being would not be perfect, since his being is his act of understanding. Now, if anything is perfectly known, it follows of necessity that its power is perfectly known. But the power of anything can be perfectly known only by knowing to what that power extends. Since, therefore, the divine power extends to other things by the very fact that it is the first effective cause of all things, God must necessarily know things other than himself.
What's more, God not only knows, he loves.
God loves all existing things. For all existing things, insofar as they exist, are good, since the being of a thing is itself a good, as is likewise whatever perfection it possesses. Now, God's will is the cause of all things. It must needs be, therefore, that a thing has some being and some kind of good, only inasmuch as it is willed by God. Hence, since to love anything is nothing else than to will good to that thing, it is manifest that God loves everything that exists, yet not as we love.
As the treatise on God unfolds still further, Thomas moves on into properly theological territory. He inquires into the Trinitarian nature of the divine life. This subject is not the business of the philosopher, yet the treatise bears reading because it thoughtfully reinterprets some accepted philosophical notions. The triune God, so to speak, bursts the ordinary meaning of unity because of the abundance of being and life that's contained within the Godhead. The mysterious and sacred fusion of unity and multiplicity in the one God is as much like a family of individuals as it's like one individual. Yet the triune God is utterly unlike both. In his analysis, Thomas stretches the boundaries of standard categories like unity and simplicity, sameness and difference, relation and personhood. The philosopher, in principle, can't follow Thomas the theologian into that realm of religious and spiritual revelation. He may not even want to. Nevertheless, the explosion of ordinary meanings caused by the revelation can give a philosopher pause. It can return him to more familiar paths with a new wariness about accepting the obvious. In the unity of the divine nature, the ordinary notion of relation as a connection between two or more things gives way to a transcendental notion that relations can be people charged with absolute independent reality. With considerable understatement, Thomas remarks,
"A difficulty seems to arise from the fact that while the divine persons are multiplied, the essence nevertheless retains its unity."
Perhaps the most accurate meaning of Thomas's observation is that some theologians believe divine relations to be external connections between independent divine persons as they are, in a way, between human persons. Thomas continues,
"In the relations, they thus considered only the idea of reference to another, and not the relations as realities in themselves. In creatures, relations are accidental, whereas in God, they are the divine essence itself."
As he turns to his treatise on creation, Thomas considers how creatures proceed from God. The causal relation between creatures and God is ever on his mind. He says that God's causation, looked at from the point of view of a creature, is the creature's participation. For as Thomas's proof of God intends to show, the creature receives its very being by participating in God's continuing presence. Knowingly or not, the creature exists in the presence of God. The participant, then, is not a moment in a time sequence or a link in a chain of causes. The participant is precisely a creature, a partner in a simultaneous vertical causation. In this unique communication, there's a continuing influx of being from the Creator, an influx that constitutes the whole and entire creature in its actual existence. And also, in this unique participation, a creature receives its own essence and its existence.
That God gives being to a creature depends on God's will. Nor does he conserve things in being otherwise than by continually giving being to them.
Thomas asks whether the perfections of all things are in God. He replies that they are, but in a very different and higher way. The arguments against Thomas's position find their force in opposing attitudes about simplicity and complexity. Some objectors believe simplicity has an empty meaning, as with an empty cupboard that has no contents and is devoid of internal differences. These objectors set the simplicity of God against the multitude of determinations found in things.
It seems that the perfections of all things are not in God, for God is simple, whereas the perfections of things are many and diverse. Therefore, the perfections of all things are not in God.
Make up your mind, these objectors seem to say. God is either simple and therefore indeterminate, or he is filled with determinate content and therefore not simple. In a word, he's either simple or perfect, but not both. Another objector voices the difficulty literally.
Opposites cannot coexist. Now, the perfections of things are opposed to each other, for each species is perfected by its own specific difference. Therefore, because opposites cannot coexist in the same subject, it seems that the perfections of all things are not in God.
If a thing is green, then it's not some other color, and it can't be both simultaneously. Or again, if a thing is a lion, then it's not a lamb. And in general, if a being contained all perfections, it would be at war with itself. Therefore, to attempt to maintain simplicity and fullness in one and the same being is contradictory. The objector voices the ancient conundrum of the one and the many as it comes to a head in the divine nature. To resolve the impasse, Thomas compares the manner in which perfection exists in a cause and also in an effect. He says,
"Whatever perfection exists in an effect must be found in the producing cause, either in the same way as when man reproduces man, or in a higher degree. Thus, the likeness of whatever is generated by the sun's power is in the sun. Now, it is plain that the effect pre-exists in the power of the agent in a more perfect way. Since, therefore, God is the first producing cause of things, the perfections of all things must pre-exist in God in a higher way."
If a cause belongs to the same order as an effect, as do, for example, the human parent and the human child, then the specific perfection exists in both in the same basic way. In this example, both parent and child have the capacity for being human, though they will differ as individuals. Thomas calls this a univocal likeness. But what if a perfection communicates to a receiver across these lines of resemblance? For example, the sun causes many effects that don't resemble the fiery ball in the heavens. It surely causes plants to grow and enables people to see. If we can speak here of a likeness at all between the cause and its effects, the similarity is not within the same order. Thomas calls this an equivocal or analogous likeness. He frequently speaks of the likeness that holds between cause and effect.
In every agent, that is properly called power by which the agent acts. Now, everything that produces something by its action produces something like itself.
If we're to understand this maxim, however, we must abandon any notion of a physical resemblance. The likeness spoken of is not necessarily proportional, as in a scale model. It doesn't resemble someone as a photograph does. It's not a formal likeness at all. It's a likeness of presence. Let's consider the opposite case. If we blot out the sun, in its absence, the green leaves will pale. Growth will stop and decay will begin. There's no formal resemblance between sun and chlorophyll or between sun and increasing plant size, but there is a real relation of presence. In this example, the presence is the solar energy which transforms the plant and which itself is transformed in the plant. So too is existence received and transformed in the creature. The primary and ultimate presence, Thomas argues, is the act of being. God, as first cause, communicates to us this presence of being. This presence of being is not a merely psychological presence. It's not an idea in a mind, nor a cosmological presence, that is, a presence of a thing in nature. The presence of being is an ontological presence. The actuality of being stands prior to all else in every being. Without it, there is total absence. The presence of being is communicated from God to us, from the cause to the effect. Such a presence already exists in God in a higher, more eminent, and active manner. Now, Thomas asks, what is the precise way in which God may be said to contain the perfection of the things he creates? He replies that God is the supreme agent who makes things be. In this sense, then, all the perfection of things pre-exist in God in the most perfect way, not as they are in themselves, but as they are in God's power to give them being.
This is the end of Part 5. Please download Part 6 to continue.